Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal, which aims to make sense of our COVID-19 world today and tomorrow. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi, researcher, author, and speaker from Brand Positive. As a researcher, I've spent 20 years conducting ethnographic interviews on global projects. Along the way, I've been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom I'll be talking to in this series. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, empathy, and privacy, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, looked into innovation, behavioural change, and the climate crisis. So, I hope you enjoy the interviews, and if so, please tell your friends, leave a rating, and watch out for our other episodes. Now, without further delay, let's crack on with today's podcast. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by John Dunleavy. John's the global president of 8Bar and the WPP global client leader on IBM. He spent the last 10 years leading agencies and working with some of the most iconic tech brands in the world, helping them to reinvent, transform, and above all, remain relevant in a category that shifts daily. Before switching over to WPP, he was the global president at M-United McCann. Prior to that, he was the exec VP and managing director of Saatchi & Saatchi New York City. He believes there's no better time to be in business, and the talent is pushing the boundaries of creativity, and at the same time, technology is helping us reinvent the way that the agency solves their clients' biggest problems faster than the world is changing around them. So, John, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Sean. Good to speak to you again.
Fantastic. Now, I know you mentioned today I'm in sunny Brighton by the coast in England, and you're over in, I believe, glorious Connecticut.
Connecticut, yeah, about 50 miles north of New York City. It's a little blustery. I think there's some bad weather coming, but it's a lovely part of the world by the water, so I feel very privileged to live out here, especially during this crisis we're in at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, and the crisis, I mean, on that, I mean, I literally just 10 minutes ago when I was just looking at the American press over here, I think it's in today's New York Times, there's just a stat you can hardly believe you're reading. So, 30.4 million people now jobless and 61,000 plus dead. I mean, it's staggering.
It is really staggering, Sean, and unthinkable, right? Who would have thought 6 months ago would be in this situation? I read this morning in the Wall Street Journal that I think a decade of job gains were erased in the month of April in the US, which Whoa. Is, phenomenal. I think in our business, we're trending in a similar way. I think there are 36,000 job losses in April. There's a kind of full-time workforce in the ad business in the US of around 200,000, just over 200,000, 207,000. So almost 20% of the U.S. ad workforce was let go in April.
Wow. I mean, just in terms of, I mean, that is just an incredible statistic. And it's the first time I've heard, anyone mention a specific sector on that level. And just, a stat that obviously all the human stories behind that are utterly appalling. But that stat just absolutely, make crikey, 20% of the US ad force. In terms of it, I mean, you've been leading agencies for years. How does one lead and what does one do, quite frankly, in a time like this where presumably, what was happening when you get into work, it has dramatically changed or got even sort of more dramatically appalling by the time one finishes at the end of the day.
Yeah, indeed. I think as an agency leader, you have to put your people first. So look out for the people that are working for the agency, which is, very difficult given we're all working remotely, but their safety and well-being is obviously the priority. So I think most agencies and holding companies have kind of mobilized very quickly, got kind of lots of well-being, mental health programs kind of established and up and running. So that's been helpful. Unfortunately, we can't carry the same amount of staff that we would normally because of our clients, right? So we're dependent on our clients. Some categories are, you know, are surging, actually spending more. So pharmaceuticals, some CPG, some are holding. So technology seems to be holding. But then obviously if you're in automotive or transport or, you know, hotels, airlines, they're just not spending any money. And so people, capital, business, we can't afford to have people kind of sat around not doing anything. I think some of the programs that most of the agencies have done, the furloughing, which allows employees to keep the benefits, you know, are good, not ideal to not do that to anybody. But I think we're managing as best we can given the situation.
I saw another thing on that in terms of the impact and how it's hitting categories and different sectors. There, I mean, a headline that was repeated, I think, across virtually every bit of the business press where everyone looked was that you know, the impact on, for instance, Unilever and Procter and Gamble, and where they are seeing things going. And there's a thing about, you know, so to take your point forward about, you know, certain categories are, inverted commas, benefiting while others are being absolutely nailed by this. So the same for Unilever, you know, if you're the, whatever, the brand manager running Domestos, then things are, you know, sales are massively up. But if you're the one running the ice cream brands or whatever, then they're massively down. Yeah, there are absolutely sort of, you know, snakes and ladders sort of thing.
Definitely. I think a stat I read recently, Clorox, which is obviously a big brand here in the US, their overall sales are up around 32% in the first quarter, which is
standard. And what do they do? Sorry, John?
Clorox kind of wipes, bleaches and things like that. So cleaning products, right? But then you also have, you know, things that... you know, Peloton, which was widely derided a few months ago because they had an appalling ad. You know, their sales are up, revenues up 66% in the first quarter.
Which
is pretty amazing. Video companies as well, you know, Activision, who make Call of Duty, their sales are up around 20 odd percent year on year Q1. So, there's some winners and some losers for sure.
And what about, I mean, you know, not asking you to give any sort of you know, corporate confidential information, but I mean, in terms of, you know, obviously, you know, you're the sort of global client lead for IBM, a fairly massive job, to put it mildly. I was just looking at the IBM site just now, and I mean, something we've seen, first of all, across the board, I think, from or certainly across category, is that, you know, the amount of brands who have been clearly standing up to be counted and doing useful things, and then you've got a lot of others who've been basically either utterly useless, or in other ways are actually, have come out with such negative sort of points of view, whatever, we're going to hardly believe it. I think certainly, and this is me saying it, not you, but I think Richard Branson has probably had the most sort of cataclysmic, COVID sort of a time of any sort of brand. Meanwhile, on the IBM site, I saw the statement there saying, to help fight COVID-19, IBM, in partnership with the White House and the Department of Energy, has created a consortium to give researchers free access to over 400 petaflops of computing capacity. I'd never heard, I must admit, of a petaflop before. So I looked it up. Yeah. And a petaflop, just so you all know, a unit of computing speed equal to 1,000 million floating point operations per second. So there we are. If no one else, I've learned something today. but in terms of what sort of IBM are up to, and apart from that, perhaps, or in addition to that, I mean... or other brands that you're aware of within the business. Any things that you can sort of talk about in terms of brands that are doing things that have clearly been done to help, you know, for the public good?
Technology is a really interesting category in a time like this, right? That technology has the power to do so much good, right? It's kind of cool that I can switch the lights on in my house, you know, with my mobile phone, or that I can order some groceries from a personal assistant like Alexa. But I think technology has the power to do so much more. And I think those technology companies that are stepping forward now, like IBM, so using their supercomputer to try and find a cure, or giving away free Watson software for people doing clinical trials on COVID-19, or mobilizing its developer community. In, they have a program called Call for Code. So Call for Code this year is all about sustainability, but now also about COVID-19 and finding not just a cure for COVID-19, solutions to some of the surrounding problems. So I think Microsoft are another company that I think that that do put the best foot forward in times like this. But I think IBM specifically, they're one of those organizations that always step up in a time of crisis. And I think are seen somewhat as a lighthouse and almost a reference point for a lot of business leaders, and even a reference point for the White House. It was the same during the financial crisis in 2008, mm-hmm. after the financial crisis broke. They really stepped up and helped businesses and partners.
Mm. And then in terms of, apart from the way that brands are changing, to come back to your role and the types of roles you've been doing, and you mentioned how, you know, when we're seeing enormous upheaval in ad land, and that's after a decade that was, you know, the biggest buzzword in advertising, or in marketing services generally over the last decade, I think has been, you know, obviously disruption. So you can't move without someone, you know, who's the first person that can say disruption is one of those things, you know, in most meetings or conferences, you know. But, you know, so after a decade where people thought they had been clearly disrupted, and it's almost like what else could happen, and now something that's coming obviously that is cataclysmic. Just in terms of, again, the whole leadership side of things. So again, I mean, I know you've been leading different agencies for over a decade. What about leadership styles? Has, you know, when you're going to, I don't know, leadership events or giving talks on it, have you seen the style of leadership changing over the last sort of decade? You know, is what a leader is required to do different now than it was, you know, certainly when you went into the industry?
You know, I think leaders are still expected to, you know, to provide a vision, right, and a roadmap on how to achieve that vision. But I think the way in which they do it has definitely changed. I think there's much more transparency. It's a much more collaborative approach, I think, versus the kind of command and control of leadership that we've seen in the past. I think, you know, social media has helped as well. When Arvind Krishna took over as CEO, early April, I mean, what a time to take over as CEO. Is the first thing he did was an open letter on LinkedIn. So, you know, that's real transparency into his vision and what he's trying to do for IBM. So I think things like that are much more common.
And what about, there's been a lot of talk, I mean, obviously now, from the point of view of the amount of sort of, you know, home working going on, and how everyone or vast amounts of people have been furloughed, certainly in the UK where I'm sitting now, in terms of the specifics of agency world, there's been quite a lot of talk about it could well be that, you know, like, okay, the government is naturally is laying out which sectors need to get back to work first. So, you know, which types of businesses will be allowed to have people walking back through the doors. And there's a lot of talk about, you know, what actually advertising is going to be fairly, you know, a long way down that list of, you know, of vital businesses or sectors that the government actually says, right, you know, now it's your turn. Are you getting any feel for that over there in terms of when, you know, when does the, when are the doors flung open again, in whatever format that they are going to be flung open?
It's obviously a topic of discussion at the moment with all of WPP's operating companies. You know, we have a lot of real estate in New York City. We have a lot of people. And I think we're going to be very careful. As you say, we're not exactly essential workers, and we're very fortunate that we can do what we do from home and pretty effectively. And I'm amazed at how well we've done over the past few months. You know, my team hasn't skipped a beat. In fact, we're busier than ever, and I think more productive than ever. So they've done a fantastic job. And I think that's true across kind of Ogilvy, Mindshare, and most of the WPP operating companies. So we're not going to rush back. You know, the safety of our people is paramount, as I mentioned before. And I think it's going to be much more of a personal choice, right? You know, if you're out here in leafy Connecticut, you know, the city's probably not very appealing. However, if you're in a one bedroom department with four other people in, you know, in one of the of Manhattan, going to the office probably seems pretty appealing right now. So I think we're going to give people, we're going to take our time, we're going to do it properly, and we'll give people a choice. And I think a lot of other categories are going to do that as well. You know, the knock-on effect there is, you know, commercial real estate in a city like Manhattan if organizations like a WPP, you know, don't need as much office space, what happens to a place like Manhattan? It's pretty interesting.
And well, absolutely. And just say in terms of what's going to happen both to the office space, but also if like what's going to happen to the agency world itself. I mean, there's a lot of talk about it. There's going to be, you know, a real scramble for every bit of business going. You know, it's going to be really sort of, you know, gloves off time in terms of businesses, you know, chasing down every client that they can. I mean, there's a, again, in terms of being sort of fair about this, I mean, I've been interviewing a lot of people from really interesting leading edge independent agencies who have a very, very specific point of view in terms of how they go out there and how they position themselves and, if you like, in the independent sector. And the other day I was doing a thing with a Network One who, you know, I know you're very familiar with them, that, you know, biggest independent agency network in the world. So they, and this will be deliberately provocative to allow you to fight back. They're saying global agency networks are neither well designed for original thinking nor are they particularly well designed for local customization. So when you hear that, before you then go berserk with rage, you know, how do you fight back against that sort of, you know, almost like positioning statement from the independent networks or independent agencies and operators?
Yeah, obviously it's quite self-serving for an independent to say that, right? I obviously don't believe that's true. I think, you know, 10 years ago, a client might go to an agency brand because of their reputation. So, you know, Adroga, Wieden & Kennedy, Goodby, you know, huge creative reputations, really great agencies. But I think when you look at what's happened over the past, say, 4 or 5 years at agencies like McCann, so Rob Riley has done a fantastic job there. There's the same level of creativity in McCann, which is a huge global network, as there is in a Goodby or a Droga or one of those smaller independent specialist shops. I think, you know, clients buy people, right? Or say buy people, it sounds awful. I think they want a partnership, and it's about the talent. I think broadly, we've all got the, you know, the same capability, whether that's, you know, in technical capability with a lot of the new things that are coming on like DCO or whether it's production. But the big differentiator is talent. And I do think in a time like this, a big global network is a safe haven for talent, right? If you've got, you know, a broad range of clients in different categories, it's probably more appealing than, say, going to a smaller shop that when things get a little shaky, you know, the shop could quite easily shut down. But McCann, Ogilvy, Wunderman Thompson, VML Y&R, they're not going anywhere, right? They've been around for a long time. They'll continue to evolve, of course. But they're going to be around for a lot longer. That answers the question. But
And just say then, I mean, what about the angle? I mean, to look across business in a sort of in a broader perspective. I mean, The Economist last week, and I've asked another couple of people I've spoken to recently about this. You know, you'll be very familiar with. You know, The Economist came out and they said, in terms of their projection on where this really goes, they were putting this down. You know, the three key drivers for business. You know, I know sweeping statement, but basically, you know, the three key drivers for most businesses are going to be put under three headlines, and they are the faster adoption of new technologies and an inevitable retreat from global supply chains, because a lot of those have broken down during this pandemic, so people will be, you know, manufacturing more locally. And then third, they're putting this down as to a worrying rise in well-connected oligopolies, as in, you know, obviously the a retrenching of the bigger, particularly tech brands, and everyone else basically dissipates. And they're putting that, I think, across a lot of sectors. So the really giant get even bigger, and then the question is, what happens to everyone else? Is it a question, you know, of, you know, certain bits of everyone else? You know, you know, is it better to be, you know, either giant or very small, or giant and in the middle, or giant and just what? You know, where are you coming from in that one?
Well, yeah, there's a couple of questions in there. Just the first part of that was the adoption of technology. I absolutely agree with that. That's going to accelerate. I mean, we're seeing that right now. If you think about all of the businesses that rely on face-to-face selling, so the automotive industry, for example, if you can't be face-to-face with a customer, you have to use digital channels, digital tools, technology to move people along that customer journey and close the sale. So I think there's going to be a super fast move to technology, and it's going to, I think, as soon as we're kind of out of the woods with the pandemic, they're accelerating their move to things like the cloud, as an example. So I don't even know, Sean, only 20% of the world's data is actually on the cloud. That's only 20% of the world's data, which is, I think, an unbelievable. So the opportunity for someone like an IBM or a Microsoft or a Google or an Amazon is that 80%. And I think if you're a CEO or a CTO whose data is still on a server during a pandemic, you're probably scared to death of things like security, accessing your data. So I think that move to cloud will certainly accelerate. And then with the move to cloud, you'll have the adoption of AI technologies as well. The second part of your question was about global supply chain. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think there'll be some change in the global supply chain, but you know, people are moving production from China to Vietnam, so you know, it's not exactly moving back to domestic countries. So I think there'll be some change, but I still think there'll be a global supply chain. Just from a, you know, from a cost basis, it's not impossible, but it changes the cost basis of products and services, you know, exponentially by bringing a production to a country like the US, as an example. And then the third part of that was big companies continue to get bigger. I think so. It's hard to predict, but that's my sense. But we'll have to see.
And what about the issue of coming back slightly from that, and that is the tech lash? Because certainly, a couple of years ago, so for instance, when I wrote my first book, The Post-Truth Business, a lot of that was around the tech lash with regards to things that had happened, with regards to all the data scraping and the impact of, you know, the hyper-targeting activity by people like Facebook and the info about Cambridge Analytica. Is it the case now that... has the tech lash basically dissipated, and are now people now viewing Silicon Valley effectively as their friends and not as something to be suspicious of, or what?
I don't think we're completely past the tech lash. I think during this pandemic, people have realized that technology is a part of the fabric of their everyday life, right? They just can't really live without it. But it also is a divider, right? If you come from a poorer neighborhood where you might not have access to a computer or even the internet, that puts you at a huge disadvantage personally and professionally. So I think what we'll see is more of a push to democratize technology, make it accessible for everybody. You know, I do work with the Borough of Manhattan Community College. It's a community college downtown, the World Trade Center site, and the average income of their students is around $20,000. So when you think about that in an area like New York, it's very, very low. And so these kids have struggled to study over this period just because they've not had access. And so we've had a big push to get computers donated, to make sure that the kids can get access, to the internet as well. So I think that's going to be an issue moving forward, and I think there'll be a lot of energy around that in the coming months and years.
And then what about just completely sort of changing tack for a second in terms of, you know, your route into all this? I mean, in terms of, you know, if you were to be advising someone now coming into the industry, or you know, there's a lot of talk, sorry, to be clear about that, there's a lot of talk about what's going to happen to all the graduates this year that are you know effectively now having paid for their you know sort of college education and had anticipated going into in the context of this conversation into the communications sector in all of its guises, where now, as you were saying earlier on, we've just seen 20% of the entire US ad workforce being let go. What's your advice now for someone who's just graduated perhaps and is thinking, should I even attempt to get into that world, or is it going to be down on its knees for years? You know, should they be looking elsewhere, you know, something in another direction completely?
My advice would be to sit tight. You know, the agency business, we do cut deep in downturns. That's true. But then we also come back pretty quickly as well on the upturn. You know, a lot of our discussions now with clients are really about what happens next or what happens, you know, post pandemic. How do we market? You know, what's the right tone? What's the right level? But people aren't going to stop marketing. You know, they're going to come back stronger than ever. And as you said, it's going to be more competitive than ever. So I think agencies are in a good spot.
Okay. I mean, I know certainly, I mean, you know, the death of advertising, inverted commas, has been long foretold. And it just seems every few years, because that's it, it's all over, you know. And yet, you know, they always say that advertising is the sort of the shock troops of capitalism, and they just, you know, it's endlessly replicated itself. I mean, again, there's been a lot of talk over the last couple of years. And I remember actually you gave me some great quotes to my first book, When You're at McCann, about the campaign or should say the activity that was probably, you know, one of the most successful bits of activity of all time, and that was Fearless Girl. And it's interesting right. to me this week that they've seen lots of images of Fearless Girl, you know, wearing a mask, as in a COVID, you know, sort of a protection yeah. mask, whatever, to yeah. really sum up that. I mean, what about that debate that goes, you know what, advertising in terms of classic TV ads, it's all over, yesterday's stuff, and now it's all about demonstrating what you're about in real life as opposed to talking about it. Where are you on that in terms of is it as black and white as that, or is there sort of a percentage that you sort of tend to go after, or what, you know, is it all change, or are there bits of the sector that are really firing ahead and other ones that quite frankly are over?
I think a lot of it depends on the client, the category, and the consumers or customers that you're trying to reach and engage. You know, it's a day doesn't go by when I see a LinkedIn post saying the agency model is dead. Usually from someone, you know, some consultancy somewhere. Again, it's self-serving, right? So it's easy to kind of throw stones from the outside and say the agency model's dead without actually telling us what the new model is going to be. So it gets a little boring. But TV, you know, it's a really effective medium. If you want to reach a huge amount of people in a short amount of time, buy a Super Bowl spot. You know what I mean? It is an effective medium. That's why people still use it. As you know, right? You know, clients have very sophisticated measuring tools, multi-touch attribution tools, and so they know which part of the media are effective versus not, and they wouldn't continue to buy, you know, broadcast TV if it wasn't working for them. So are there other tools available to them? Of course there are. But I think TV will continue to play a pretty big role for most advertisers, certainly in the US.
Well, it's interesting that, I mean, over here, I mean, you know, one of the industry spokespeople that's always quoted is Mark Ritson. And he was, I saw him giving a talk last week. And he was absolutely adamant that what you should be doing now is, you know, foot on the pedal and advertising, you know, absolutely, you know, increasing your ad budget, because, you know, he came up with his endless stats from past downturns, inverted commas, whereby most people effectively did stop advertising, and it was the ones that kept on doing it that actually did far better as a result, because not only did they, you know, keep their share of voice, they actually increased it because the others had actually withdrawn. So the market was that much bigger, if you like, or the voice market was that much bigger. So he would say, keep on going, you know, don't blink.
I agree with some caveats. Media consumption is up massively because people are at home. Mm-hmm. The cost of media is down because there are fewer advertisers. And because there are fewer advertisers, you've got much more of an opportunity to have a bigger voice in the marketplace. But the caveat is this. I think you have to have credibility and permission to have a voice during a time like this. For someone like IBM, because they are doing so much to help, not just find a cure for COVID, but to help with the problems that surround it, they really have credibility and can have have permission to have a voice. If you're fast food, CPG, maybe not. But I think a lot of it comes down to, purpose in a way, which is, wildly overused and misused, I think. But if you have a real authentic purpose and reason for being at a time like this, then sure, get out there.
Okay. And then a completely different thing. I mean, certainly in terms of, as a sort of, not say a side issue, but something that you'd be observing in your role. I mean, I know, because often I see your stuff on social media in terms of you seem to be jumping on and off planes, or certainly used to be jumping on and off planes almost constantly. And as you sort of travel around the world, I mean, to you, in terms of truly dynamic countries or regions, how do you view it from the lofty heights of leadership? In which parts of the world, again, now, if you're advising someone to go and work in a particular country, for instance, if one literally just had the choice, where would you see now as being somewhere that is super dynamic?
Ironically, China. I think they're going to bounce back from this. Obviously, they're going to have some reputational issues, but it's still, I think, one of the most dynamic and fastest growing economies in the world. I think there are creative hubs as well that continue to be kind of beacons for creativity. London, Amsterdam, Paris, you can never discount them. I think it's interesting in the US that there are kind of hotspots popping up in places like Portland Greenville, South Carolina. There's a fantastic agency there called EP & Co. that my friend runs. So that there's these kind of pockets of creativity that are popping up. And a lot of it depends on, the state and how they're run. Some states are really investing in 5G and technology and making themselves kind of really attractive places for people to put down roots.
I think that's one of the things that I read about that in the last book, in Influences and Revolutionaries, because that whole thing, the thing that really goes back to people like Richard Florida, like a decade ago when he wrote, Rise of the Creative Class. And one of his key points there about, and he then spent a long time basically just flying around the world talking with city mayors about this, which was at that point thought to be quite a revolutionary thought, which was, creative people or like-minded people cluster together. If you want to either rejuvenate a particular bit of your city or indeed rejuvenate your particularly secondary city in total, then make it super creative and, empowering and interesting and empathetic. And hence, and I think they used to use classically the Williamsburg or the Shoreditch model for rejuvenating and powering a particular bit of an existing city, or they'd be looking, as you just said, to something like Portland, Oregon, as an example of, or Brighton, England, where I am now, as being an example of a creative powerhouse that, that punches well above its weight in terms of, creative output or, sort of a catalytic thinking, as they say. What about the city that you grew up in, can I say, John? Manchester. I mean, that has always been renowned as being a powerhouse of a creative city. The amount of things going on there that have come out of that city are extraordinary. I mean, do you go back there at all? I have no idea. Are you?
My mother still lives there. My sister, nephew, and niece. So I we try and go back a few times a year with the family. It's definitely changed a lot since I was there. It's gone through somewhat of a renaissance. In many ways, I think it's lost some of the rough edges that made it special. It's almost some areas of Manchester feel like a mini London. My Mancunian friends will hate me for saying that, but
I was going to say, what an insult.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's a Selfridges, a Harvey Nichols, you know, in the center of town and things like that. So, you know, there's some areas, kind of the northern quarter, which is still have a little bit of an edge to them. But yes, yeah, it's a great, great town.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier on that you mentioned couldn't quite grab the town's name, but you said your friend of yours runs an agency called, was it EP and Co? And where were they? What was the town?
Greenville, South Carolina.
Okay.
Yeah, which is again one of those little towns that has it's really coming up. You know what's interesting about Greenville as well? There are a ton of cycling teams based there because there's a mountain range which is not dissimilar to the French Alps. So a lot of these cycling teams base themselves there as well. My friend Connor has this agency which really punches above its weight. It's got some kind of big national clients. You know, a lot of regional smaller agencies have regional smaller clients, but I think we're starting to see that, you know, clients are just as happy working with an agency as long as the talent is there. Doesn't necessarily have to be in New York or San Francisco or Chicago.
Just such a great, name. Greenville, South Carolina does sound quite, quite very cinematic. It was like American town, sort of smallish American towns, you know, always sound just so, they have a very sort of romantic aura about them. That certainly has it. And what about, in terms of, do you say, you know, other main cities in the US and what they are up to in terms of, you know, building a real, I don't know, people talk about sort of, you know, national branding, and we've seen a lot of sort of city branding done over the last few years. Any of those sort of big sort of, you know, almost, we say, inverted commas, forgotten cities that are now coming back? Any of those that you would think of that in terms of places that are now, yeah, re-emerging?
Detroit is the obvious one, right? Because of the, you know, the auto industry and how dominant it was there. And then kind of large part of auto manufacturing went to, you know, other parts of the world. I think that's definitely come back pretty strong in the past few years. Seattle is an amazing town. You know, it was at the time just Microsoft was in Seattle, right? So San Francisco was really the hotbed for technology. And now you have Amazon there. Obviously, Boeing's been there for a long time. So, you know, if you were starting up a tech company, I'd certainly think of Seattle over San Francisco, just from cost basis, the talent available. So that's kind of quite an interesting dynamic, I think, on the West Coast.
Mm. And what about in terms of the impact on towns? I mean, again, I think one of the points The Economist was talking about recently, because you've both got, I'm not asking you to talk about this in a sort of on a party political basis, but obviously you've got the impending American presidential election coming up. Right. And at the same time, The Economist said, as you've got in front of me, it says that one of the things that's going to be falling out of all this is, and I quote this, they say, it may prove that parts of the US hardest hit by the pandemic, which have generally been cities, because obviously people are physically nearer together, hence more people get it. So they're saying, so may prove that parts of the country hardest hit by the disease are not the parts hit hardest economically, which will probably be rural and post-industrial areas already in decline. Now, from a UK stroke European perspective, you know, we see lots of these images of, you know, effectively, if I the middle bit in the States and areas within the middle bit, which are often appear to be in decline. Do you agree with that? I mean, is it going to be a case that the cities, you know, for instance, you know, again, we've seen all the terrible stats coming out of New York in terms of the appalling impact of C-19 on New York. But is it a case that something like New York bounces back fairly quickly? But as The Economist puts it, it's those rural and post-industrial areas which just get absolutely nailed even more.
Yeah, I mean, I think geography has something to do with it, right? Because of the, you know, a place like New York is obviously built up and highly populated. But I think it's the biggest impact is in low paid jobs, right? Unfortunately, and you know, if you're unskilled, you're one of the, you know, the few jobs that aren't kind of vulnerable to, say, AI and automation. Things like, you know, food service, construction, production line, And a lot of those jobs are outside of the big cities. And so I think those people are going to be unfortunately hit hardest. And as a result, I think this election is going to be about jobs, right? I mean, it's the highest unemployment since the Great Depression. And I think what's weird about it, it's almost obscene, is that, you know, on I think it's Tuesday when the job numbers were announced, the stock market, you know, rose a couple of percent. And so I think that politicians often try and draw a line from the stock market, the Dow, to the health of the economy. And I think people are going to see through that this time around, because, you know, they're going to be there jobless when the Dow is kind of still on fire and it won't really mean anything to them.
And then something else that is, again, very much of the moment in terms of the potential long-term impacts of all this, and that is the issue of all things green stroke sustainable stroke environmental sort of climate crisis, ecological emergency connected. So I mean, only a few months ago, for instance, we had so Greta Thunberg was in New York having sailed over the Atlantic, you know, obviously gave a great speech to at the UN, and there seemed to be an enormous amount of power and positivity and forward sort of action and movement around, if you like, the green lobby and a green future. There's quite a lot of talk, I know, in the American press at the moment about actually a lot of that being put in the back burner. You know, people talking about, headlines like, last year, the buzzword was sustainability. And you know what? Actually, this crisis changes that completely. Where are you on that one in terms of people having to focus on the here and now and perhaps beginning to quietly walk away from the ecological and climate debate?
Yeah, you know, well, first of all, I do think Greta is a very impressive young human, and she's not wrong about the climate, is she? But I tend to agree, Sean, it's a matter of focus, isn't it? When something like this happens, you're really focused on just getting, yourself back on your feet and kind of back into the workforce, getting the economy going again, obviously people's health on top of that. So I would tend to agree.
Okay. And then what about just the last few questions? And it's been brilliant. It's actually a really interesting sort of wide-ranging discussion, John. But the issue around, a trend headline of the moment would very often be something like, what we've seen as a result of all of this is, as a result of the pandemic, are, friends and neighbors helping each other out, communities coming together, families reconnecting, selfishness being absolutely, frowned on as never before. So what that means is that we've moved away from the obsessive interest and focus on oneself, which many say is what basically advertising has always been about. How can I, look better than my neighbor, and how can I have a faster car and all that sort of stuff? So are we seeing a move from the me to the we? Does that stack up with you
I think a little too early to tell. It reminds me of an interesting story, which is the opposite, right? So there's, pandemics, I guess, can bring the worst out of people as well as the best out of people. There was a man in Tennessee who bought, I think, like 18,000 bottles of hand sanitizer and was going to sell them on Amazon, price gouge people. Shamed on social media and ended up donating all of it to, to local hospitals. I think it could be polarizing. I think some people kind of retreat, right, and kind of go into more of a self-preservation mode, which is in itself kind of selfish. Some people much more altruistic about it. I think too early to tell, but we'll see.
Okay. And then what about the sort of the tactics for business survival. I mean, there's a lot of talk about people, you know, obviously having to adapt to what is going on now in order to survive and just, you know, keep businesses going. Again, without giving away any sort of, you know, corporate sort of secrets, I mean, what sort of activity, perhaps not so much your own organization, but, you know, when you talk with your sort of friends in the sort of in the lofty leadership circles that you hang around in, I mean, you know, what sort of things are they talking about in terms of, you know, how businesses are now, particularly creative businesses, what are they up to in terms of, you know, I hate to use the word pivot, but I have, in order to actually, you know, get back on the front foot and all this?
You know, from my personal point of view, is we need to focus on our clients, right? It's at times like this, you know, we're a service business. We are here in service of our clients, brands, and businesses. And I think sometimes agencies particularly forget that, and it's kind of central to what we do. So if we can be there for our clients and help them in any way that we can, you know, that sets us up for long-term success, those client relationships. Broader business, you know, I think there's a lot of talk about resiliency and resiliency planning. You know, what do we need to do when the next thing happens? So I think there'll be a lot of energy around that. Again, acceleration into new technology to help with that resiliency will be will be.
It's interesting. I was reading something about that the other day, I think it was in Forbes or whatever, and it's very interesting how their take on it was, in order to actually be resilient, the key thing is essentially just to focus on not being fragile. That's a really nice way of sort of focusing on that thing when everyone's trying to sort of define what does actually being resilient actually mean. Very good.
As I mentioned earlier, our biggest expense is people, right? We're a people capital business. And so we need to figure out how to make sure, you know, our people are healthy and their kind of mental well-being as well. And it's for me, it's been pretty amazing how, you know, in a matter of, you know, weeks, we went from everybody being in an office working together to everyone being at home, still working together and not really skipping a beat in terms of productivity. So I think as an industry, we're luckier than most. You know, we don't have factories or stock or, you know, machines making things. It's a people business, right?
Yeah. Very good. Look, John, that's super interesting. Thanks so much for sparing me the time to talk to me. So we covered some serious ground there, I thought the stuff certainly, you know, when we began talking about sort of leadership and what being a business leader actually means now, what it looks like, and how one actually sort of links in with teams and leads from the front in an empathetic way, I thought was super, super interesting. That the angle of, you know, I think the actions you were talking about, you know, so what does it actually look like? It's all about, I think, as you're saying, so you put people first, you know, businesses have to get involved in the problem and actually, you know, be part of the, very glib way of saying it, I know that I'm putting words in your mouth, but, you know, businesses have to get involved in order to be generally part of the solution to all of this. You've got to be creative in how a brand usefully interacts, and I think again the point you're saying on earlier on about, you know, demonstrate your integrity, right. Actually you know, do it and then talk about it. I mean, yeah, I thought very, very interesting indeed. Well, look, John, thanks so much for joining me. It was very, very good indeed. And just so people know where they can go to hear what your sort of the words of wisdom are, so where are you on social media, so how can people track you down?
Find me on LinkedIn. My Twitter handle is @Dunleavy, Dunleavy.
Very good. Right, you must have gotten there early, John, when the sort of Twitter handles are going. So you've got that, or sort of you sort of buy that for a fortune. Excellent. Anyway, so you've got.
No, I was going to say, weirdly, there's a the governor of Alaska is called Dunleavy, and is not very popular, and so I keep getting tagged with all this abuse, and I have to keep saying, no, I'm not the guy in Alaska.
Well, actually, I remember on Alaska, I remember years ago when there was Sarah Palin, she came out with that statement about, she said something like she could lean out of her window and see Russia, and everyone was like laughing at her, going, oh my God, how do I do it? But apparently it was true, because apparently there is a bit from Alaska, but there's a little Russian, there's a little island they own. And so theoretically, she was right. Who knew?
Yes.
Anyway, right, superb. Sean. Well, look, anyway, so John Dunleavy, global president, WPP client leader for IBM, who spent the last 10 years leading agencies and working with some of the most iconic tech brands in the world. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sean. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the New Abnormal podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Please leave a rating, tell your friends, and until next time, goodbye. Thank you.